This is disc number 15.
Just from where he crouched, Richard could see a good half-dozen skulls lying at least partially atop leaves, and even more rounded shapes below them. Beneath the leaves he found the rest of the bones that belonged to the skull he had stepped on. He stood slowly and began moving again, scrutinizing the ground, the fat, twisted tree trunks, as well as the limbs overhead as he went. He saw no one and heard nothing. Now that he knew what he was looking for, he was able to spot skulls seemingly everywhere. He stopped counting once he'd reached 30. The bones appeared scattered, not bunched together as if people had all died together or in groups. With a few exceptions, they appeared to have been individuals who had died at those particular places. He supposed that the bodies might have been placed there. He had no way of really knowing. The few exceptions were skulls close together, but he reasoned that might have been chance, people who had happened to have fallen near another body. Richard crouched down to inspect a number of the skulls, both those lying exposed and those buried beneath the litter. His initial thought was that it was possibly the site of a battle, but as near as he could tell in the moonlight, they had not died at the same time. There were some bones that were sound, while others were moldering away. Some appeared so ancient that they fell apart when he touched them. The place was like a graveyard, but with all of the bodies above ground, rather than being buried. The other thing that he noticed was that no predators looked to have disturbed the dead. Richard had come across remains in the woods when he had been a guide. Animals always got at the dead, human or otherwise. It looked as if each one of these bodies, though, had rotted away over time, leaving the bones lying in the exact same position in which the person had fallen, on their sides or with arms sprawled or face down. None had been laid out as if in burial, with arms neatly crossed on their chests or at their sides. They looked simply to have fallen dead. It still might not have seemed quite so peculiar, except that not one of the corpses looked to have been touched by any predator. As Richard walked endlessly through the oak grove, he wondered if it would ever end. On a moonless, cloudy night, or even a cloudy day for that matter, it was the kind of place where it would have been easy to get lost. Everything looked the same. The trees were spaced evenly, and there was nothing to indicate if he was going in the right direction, except the moon and stars. For what seemed like half the night, Richard moved ever onward through the forest of the dead. He was sure that he had followed the directions the slough had given him. The slough, however, had no way to know exactly what he would find. She had only been given directions from Barakas, and that had been 3,000 years before. The landscape could have changed a great deal since the time of Barakas. The bones, though, didn't look to be anywhere near that old. Of course, it could be that lying in the oak grove there were bones thousands of years old, but by now those would have all crumbled to dust. As Richard continued on, the woods began growing murkier, until he found himself entering the black shadows of a dark forest of immense pines, their trunks standing close together, and each nearly as big as his house back in the Heartland Woods had been. It was like encountering a wall of mountains that rose up into the sky. The trunks, like pillars, were clear of branches until somewhere up out of sight. But those branches completely closed off the sky, and left the forest floor below a dark and confusing maze among the massive trunks. Richard paused, considering how he would keep to a direction in the pitch blackness that lay ahead while being unable to move in anything resembling a straight line. That was when he heard the whispers. He cocked his head, listening, trying to make out the words. He couldn't, so he carefully stepped deeper into the gloom, letting his eyes adjust to the darkness before taking a few more steps. Before long, he began to be able to make out the shapes of the trees ahead, so he moved forward, ever deeper into the close canyons among the trunks of the monumental pines. "Go back," came a whisper. "Who's there?" he whispered back. "Go back," said a faint little voice, "or stay forever with the bones of those who have come before you. I've come to speak with the Night Wisps, Richard said.
Then you have come for nothing. Go now,
the voice repeated with more strength. Richard tried to lay the sound of the words over his memory of what a wisp sounded like. While it wasn't the same, it did have qualities in common. Please come forward so that I may talk with you. Only silence surrounded him. Richard moved ahead a dozen paces into the darkness.
Last time warned, came the eerie voice. Go, now!
I have come a long way. I'm not going back without speaking with the wisps. This is important.
Not to us.
Richard stood with one hand on a hip as he tried to conceive of what to do next. He was far from clear-headed. His weariness was hampering his thinking. Yes, this is important to you, too.
How?
I have come for what Baracus left for me.
So did those whose bones you have passed.
Look, this is important. Your lives ultimately depend upon this as well. In this struggle, there will be no uninvolved bystanders. All will be drawn into the storm.
The stories you have heard about a treasure are empty lies. There is nothing here.
Treasure? No, you don't understand. That's not what this is about at all. I think you misunderstand me. I've already passed the tests Baracus left for me. That's why I'm here. I'm Richard Rawl. I'm married to Kaelin Amnell, the Mother Confessor.
We don't know this person you speak of. Go back to her while you still can.
No, that's the point. I can't. I'm trying to find her. Frustrated, Richard ran his fingers back into his hair. He didn't know how much time he might have to say what he needed to say, or how much he should leave out, if he was to convince the wisps of his true reason for being there, to convince them to help him. You once knew her. Magic was used against Kaelin to make everyone forget her. You knew her too, but you forgot her like everyone else. Kaelin used to come here. In her role as the Mother Confessor, she fought to protect the land of the Night Wisps and to keep others out. She told me about the beautiful land of the Night Wisps. She told me about the open fields and ancient remote forests. She has been among the wisps as they gather at twilight to dance together in the grasses and wildflowers. She told me that she spent many a night lying on her back in the grass as the wisps gathered around her, speaking with her of things common to both your lives, of dreams and hopes, of loves. Please, the wisps knew her. She was your friend. Richard saw then a tiny light come out from behind a tree.
Go, or your bones will remain out there with the others who seek treasure, and no one will ever see you again or know what became of you.
If I need gold, I earn it. I have no interest in treasure. The tiny spark of light started away.
Not all treasure is gold.
As it glided into the distance, the shafts of spinning light played over the trunks of trees it passed.
I knew Shar, Richard called out.
The light paused. It stopped spinning. For a moment, Richard watched as the spark of light hung there, in the distance, faintly illuminating the closely gathered monarchs of the forest, standing like sentries for what lay beyond.
You did not come because of the legends that there was treasure to be found here?
No.
What do you know of the name you spoke?
I was with Shar after she went through the boundary. Shar crossed that boundary to help stop the threat from Darkon Rawl. Shar crossed the boundary to help in the effort to find me so that I, too, could help in that struggle. Before she died, Shar said that if I ever needed the help of the Night Wisps, that I should say her name, and they would help me, for no enemy may know it. Richard pointed back toward the grove of dead oaks, where the forgotten, moldering remains reposed. I have a feeling that none of the people whose bones lie back there knew her name, or the name of any wisp. The light slowly returned through the trees, finally coming to a stop not far from him. He could feel the softly glowing shafts of light gliding over the contours of his face. They almost felt like the faint touch of a spider's web. Richard took a small step closer. I spoke with Shar before she died. She said that she could not live away from those of her kind any longer, and she did not have the strength to return to her home place. She gave me my first test from Barakas. She said that she believed in me, believed that I had inside me what it takes to prevail. It was a message from him. She asked me about secrets. The tiny light turned a warm, rosy color as it spun in silence for a moment.
And you passed her test?
No, Richard admitted. It was too soon for me to understand it all. Later, I finally came to understand. The Slif said that I have now passed the test that Barakas left for me.
What is your name?
I grew up named Richard Cipher. Since then, I've come to learn that I am Richard Rawl. I have been called by other names as well. The Seeker, the One Born True, the Bringer of Death, Richard with the Temper, the Pebble in the Pond, and Caharin. Does one of those names mean anything to you?
Does the name Ghazi mean anything to you?
Ghazi, Richard thought a moment. No, should it?
It means fire. Ghazi was given that name by prophecy. If you were the one, you would know that name too.
I'm sorry, but I don't. I don't know why, but I can tell you that I don't hold much with prophecy.
I am very sorry, but misery has come to this land. The Wisps are in a time of suffering. We cannot help you. You should go now.
The Wisp began leaving again, spinning as it floated off into the towering trees. Richard took a step forward. Shar said that if I needed the help of the Wisps, they would help me. I need your help. The little point of light paused again. Richard got the distinct impression by the way it hovered motionless that it was considering something. After a moment, it slowly began rotating, casting off shimmering beams of light. It came partway back. The Wisp then spoke a name that Richard had not heard spoken aloud in many years. His blood turned to ice.
And does this name mean anything to you?
The Wisp asked. How do you know my mother's name? Richard whispered. The Wisp slowly drew closer.
Many, many seasons ago, Ghazi went through a dark boundary to find her, to help her, to tell her of her son, to tell her many things she needed to know, many things her son would need to know. Ghazi never returned.
Richard stared, his eyes wide. What do the Wisps do in the day, when it's light? The Wisp, like nothing more than a glowing silver ember, slowly spun, throwing shafts of light across Richard's face.
We go where it is dark. We do not like being in the light.
Does fire hurt you? The shafts of light dimmed.
Fire can kill us.
Dear spirits, Richard whispered. The Wisp came closer, the shimmering light brightening again, as it seemed to study his face.
What is it?
What was the prophecy about Ghazi? Richard asked. The slowly spinning light paused.
The prophecy was about Ghazi's death. It said he would die in fire.
Richard's eyes closed for a moment. Many seasons ago, when I was but a boy, my mother died in a fire. The Wisp remained silent. I'm sorry, Richard said in a small voice as Shota's words rang through his head. I think Ghazi died in my home. Our house caught on fire. After my mother brought my brother and me safely out, she went back in for something. We never knew what. She was probably overcome by the smoke. She never came out. I never saw her again. She died in the blaze. I think she went back for Ghazi. I think my mother and Ghazi died together in that fire, without him ever completing his purpose. The Wisp seemed to watch him for a time.
I am sorry for what happened to your mother. After all this time, tears still come to you.
Richard had run out of words and could only nod. The wisp again started spinning faster.
The name Richard Cipher is the name we know you as. Come, Richard Cipher, and we will tell you what Ghazi went to tell your mother.
Chapter 41. Richard followed the sparkling point of light into the ancient stand of timber, a place of quiet and peace. He had never seen trees this big. It struck him as odd that creatures so tiny would live among trees so big. It seemed like they walked for hours, though Richard knew that it only felt that way because he was so drained. When they at last emerged from the trees into a vast clearing, Richard could hardly believe his eyes. It was just as Kaelin had described it. The grassy meadows sparkled with hundreds of night wisps gliding among the tall blades of grasses and wildflowers. The swath of stars above, through the gap in the towering pines, seemed lifeless and dead compared with the stars in the grass. It was a beautiful sight. But it brought pain into Richard's heart because it reminded him of Kaelin, of the first day he had met her when she had introduced him to Shar, of the time she'd told him about the wisps. Kaelin and the wisps were forever linked in his mind. And now, after all this time, he knew that it was a night wisp that his mother had run back into the burning house to save. She had not died alone. All because a man thousands of years before had gone to the Temple of the Winds and done something that would result in Richard being born with both sides of the gift, both sides that the Slif said he no longer had. As Richard stepped into the grass, some of the night wisps came closer, curious to see the stranger among them. The wisps flashed brighter and dimmer, as if in conversation among themselves. "What are you called?" Richard asked the wisp who had escorted him.
"I am Tam."
Richard watched wisps gliding closer, rising up the length of him before shooting away.
"Our numbers dwindle," Tam said. "Such a thing has never happened before. It is a time of suffering for us. We don't know the cause."
"The cause is in part why I am here," Richard told him. "I'm hoping to find help so that I can stop what is causing this sickness among the wisps. If I don't succeed, you will all vanish from the world." Tam considered in silence for a time. Others who had heard Richard's words drifted away, sinking into the dark places in the grass, as if seeking a quiet place to weep. Some, though, came closer.
"Many here knew Ghazi," Tam said. "They miss him. Can you tell us any of what he said before his life was gone? The way you have spoken of Shar's words?"
"I'm sorry, Tam, but I never saw Ghazi. I never knew that he had come to see my mother. Ghazi and my mother must have died before he had a chance to tell us anything of his reason for being there." Richard wondered if that had been the reason for the fire. Many of the wisps dimmed, as if in disappointment that he could tell them none of Ghazi's last words. Richard remembered his purpose and turned to his guide. "Please, Tam, I have come for an important reason that, as I said, may in the end help the wisps with what they suffer. I have come because Barakas left something here for me. His library is here. He sent his wife with a book for me."
"Magda,"
one of the nearby wisps said. He wasn't sure which one was speaking, but it sounded decidedly more feminine than Tam. "That's right."
"This was long before our time," she said. "But the words of Barakas have been passed down to us. We still hold the secrets he asked us to keep. I am Jas. Come, Tam and I will show you."
Tam and Jas led Richard off through the silky grass, toward the towering trees to his left. Once among the trees, away from the open meadow, it was again like descending into a dark world. Only the two wisps gave him enough light to see his way. "How far?" Richard asked.
"Not far,"
said Jas.
"It is a place within our realm," said Tam. "A place where we can watch over and protect it. Over the millennia, the seed of stories planted in the fertile soil of bits and scraps of facts was watered by wishes, and began to take root and grow. Eventually, a bountiful fruit of rumors burst forth, to be spread on the wind of whispers that said we hid a fabled hoard of gold. Nothing could convince the believers that it was not true. The truth does not glitter for these people like gold does. Their dream of reaping unearned wealth was so strong for them that they would rather sacrifice everything truly precious to them than accept the truth that it was an empty belief. What we hide is not a treasure, Jas said, but a promise made by our ancestors.
It is a treasure of a sort, Richard told them. To the right person, anyway. What seemed not far to them seemed quite far to Richard. It was getting ever more exhausting for him to put one leg in front of the other. His stomach growled with hunger as they moved through the silent wood. It had to be somewhere deep in the middle of the night when the trees opened up, and Richard could see at last, illuminated by the silver moonlight, a valley spread out far below. Lush forests carpeted the bowl of the valley, with a mat of trees ascending the slopes of mountain close in on each side. The place where he stood overlooking the length of the valley was not only a commanding spot, but a place with hauntingly beautiful views of the things that Richard had always loved. He ached to be able to explore such a place, to be down in those woods, but to be there with Kaelin. Without her, beauty was only a word. Without Kaelin smiling at him, the world was empty and dead.
This is the place of the library that Master Barakas left with us for safekeeping, Tam said.
Richard looked around. He saw only ferns, some vines trailing down from the darkness above, and the massive trunks of the pines standing with him at the rim of the overlook. Where? He asked. I don't see a building anywhere.
Here,
Jas said as she drifted down to a small boulder, coming to rest atop it.
Under here is the library.
Richard scratched his scalp. It seemed an odd place for a library. But then he recalled finding the entrance to the library in Casca under a gravestone. In light of that, this made more sense. A building might have long ago been discovered and raided. He bent and put his shoulder against the rock, in a curved niche that wasn't sharp. He was sure that he wasn't strong enough to move such a huge slab of stone, but he put all his weight against the stone socket anyway. With great effort, it slowly began to pivot to the side. The wisps came close, looking with Richard at what lay below. The stone had rested on a small, carefully smoothed lip. There was no hole, no stairway down into the ground within that lip. Richard knelt and dug at what was under the rock, inside the stone lip. It was soft and dry. This is just sand.
Yes, Jas said. When Magda came, she followed her husband's instructions, using magic, and filled what was below.
Richard was incredulous. With sand?
Yes,
Jas said. How much sand? Richard asked. He wasn't looking forward to digging out a sand-filled hole, no matter how small it turned out to be.
You see that small river down in the valley?
Jas asked. Richard squinted in the dim moonlight. He saw the sparkling reflections off the water wandering among sandbars. Yes, I see it.
The words passed down to us, Jas said, say that Magda brought with her a powerful spell from Barakas. She used it to create a whirlwind that drew the sand up from the river banks and funneled it into this hole here, filling up the place below to protect it.
Protect it? Richard asked. From what?
From any who might make it this far. This sand is meant to foil anyone who might come for what is down there.
Well, I suppose that if there was enough sand, that would certainly slow them down. Richard looked over suspiciously at the two wisps spinning slowly in the moonlight. How much sand is down there, anyway? Tam floated out past the edge of the drop-off.
You see that ledge down there?
Richard carefully leaned over the edge of the cliff and looked. It had to be several hundred feet down to the narrow stone shelf. I see it.
That is how far down the rooms of the library are to be found.
The rooms of the library are buried under all this sand? Down there, at the bottom?
Yes,
Tam said. Richard was dumbfounded. There had to be a palace worth of sand. How am I to dig such a thing out? It would take forever to accomplish such a thing. Tam returned, coming close to his face.
Maybe, but Baraka said that if you were the one, you would know what to do.
If I'm the one... Richard felt the weight of discouragement, like a mountain of sand on top of him. Why do I always have to be the one? Tam spun for a moment.
That is not for us to say.
Richard groaned with the disappointment of being so close but so far. If I'm the one, then why couldn't he just leave a message for me so that I would know what to do? Tam and Jas were silent for a moment, as if thinking.
Well, there was one other thing passed down,
Jas finally said. What would that be?
Baraka said that the wisps would have to guard this for ages and ages, but when the sands of time had finally run out, the one who was meant to have the book would be here and take it with him.
Jas spun closer.
Does that help, Richard Cipher?
Richard wiped a hand across his face. Why couldn't Baraka simply tell him how to recover secrets of a war wizard's power? Maybe Baraka's thought that the man who was meant to have the book must already have mastered his power to the point where this would present no obstacle. Maybe he thought that Richard should know how to spin a magical whirlwind and suck out the sand. If that was so, then Richard was not the one. Not only did he not know how to use his power, but since being in the Slith, he no longer had his gift. As far as Richard was concerned, the sands of time had already run out for him. The Sisters of the Dark had put the Boxes of Warden in play. The chimes had contaminated the world of life, beginning the destruction of magic, which was probably the great misery the Wisps were suffering. And the army of the Imperial Order was rampaging unchecked through the new world. But worst of all for him, personally, Kaelin had been abducted. Was under the influence of the Chainfire spell, and desperately needed his help. And here he stood, waiting for the sands of time to run out. Richard took his hand away from his face as he frowned. He leaned out over the edge of the cliff, looking down at the ledge far below. The sands of time. He looked to the left side and studied the rock. He didn't see anything he could use there, but on the right, he thought he saw a way to use the rocks to climb down. He swung his pack off his back and set it on the ground, while he dug out his camp shovel and hastily assembled it. When the sands of time had finally run out, the one who was meant to have the book would be here and take it with him, he quoted. Is that what you said?
Yes, Jas said. That is what we were told.
Richard gazed out over the cliff again. I have to go down there to that ledge. He told the wisps.
We will come and light the way,
Tam said. Richard wasted no time climbing down the side of the rock precipice. It turned out to be just as difficult as he had judged it would be, but it didn't take long, and he was soon standing on the narrow shelf far below the top where he had pivoted the boulder out of the way. He searched around, picking at the face of the rock wall, until he found what he was looking for. He immediately started digging, chipping, and prying out rocks that had been so tightly jammed in that it was hard to tell for sure in the poor light of the moon and two wisps if it was really what he thought it was. When rock began coming out, his confidence level rose. The more rock fragments he pulled out, the easier it was to get out more. He had to work carefully to free some of the larger stones. One wrong step, and he could slip and fall off the narrow ledge. Some of the boulders back in the growing hole were larger than he could have lifted, so he had to roll and walk them out of the ever-expanding opening. Fortunately, he was able to loosen the rock beneath most of them and then roll them out. He stood to the side on the narrow ledge and let the rocks and boulders tumble out past him. He watched them sail out into the night air, falling soundlessly until they finally crashed down into the forest far below. Suddenly, when the shovel broke through to something soft, the rest of the rock plug began to let go with a grating sound and abruptly burst out in a cascade of fragments. Richard had to duck out of the way. With a rumbling roar, the sand followed in a column pouring far out into space before beginning to arc downward. Richard stood with his back pressed against the rock wall, his heart pounding from the surprise of the sudden explosive clearing of the opening into the hollow interior of the cliff. The two wisps spun as they watched the amazing sight. One of them, Richard wasn't sure of which one, followed the column of sand out and down for a ways before returning. It seemed to go on forever, but the last of the sand finally dwindled away as it poured out of the hole, leaving only small amounts to drizzle out in fits. Richard wasted no time climbing into the hole. "Come on," he called back to the wisps. "I need light." The two wisps obliged, passing over the tops of his shoulders to enter first. Once past him, they lit the chamber beyond. Richard stood up inside, brushing himself off as he gazed around at shelves filled with books. It was astounding to think that he was the first person who had stood in this place since Magda Cyrus, the woman who would become the first confessor. That reminded him of Kaelin and his need to find her, so he immediately started looking around. It appeared a rather simple library, with a doorway at the far side that he could see led deeper into the interior of the cliff. He saw shadows of doorways and circular stairs. Despite the sand pouring out of the hole, there was still a lot of sand covering everything. It would take some time to clean the place and really tell what was there. To the right, though, on a stone pedestal against a blank stone wall, sat a book all by itself. Richard lifted it off the stand and blew the sand and dust off of it. On the cover it said, "Secrets of a War Wizard's Power." His fingers gently glided over the gilt letters on the cover as he again read the words meant for him. It was an awe-inspiring feeling to realize that a war wizard, First Wizard Baracus himself, had made this very book for the person who would be born with the power that he saw to it would be released from the Temple of the Winds. Richard had at last found the treasure that Baracus had left for him. A night wisp hovered over each shoulder, watching him as he reverently stared at the book that would finally answer his questions, that would finally help him master his gift. Finally, his heart pounding, Richard opened the cover to see what Baracus wanted him to know. The first page was blank. Richard turned over more pages, but they were all blank. He thumbed through the entire book, and other than the words on the cover, he found that the entire book was completely blank. Richard squeezed his temples between the fingers and thumb of one hand. He thought he might be sick. "Can either of you see anything on the pages?"
"No,"
Jas said.
"Sorry."
"I see no marks of writing at all," Tam added.
Richard realized then what the problem was. His heart sank. Secrets of a War Wizard's Power was an instruction book on the use of a specific form of the gift. The book involved magic. For some reason, Richard had been cut off from his gift. Without that gift to assist him, whatever was written on the pages would not stay in his mind. He would forget the words before he could remember reading them. Just as he no longer remembered a single word of the Book of Counted Shadows, he could not remember the words of Secrets of a War Wizard's Power long enough to remember having seen any words. Without the gift, it would appear blank to him. Until he could figure out what was wrong with his gift, he wouldn't be able to read this book. "I'll have to take this with me," Richard told the wisps.
"Just as Baracus said you would, Richard Cipher," Tam said.
Richard wondered if Baracus somehow knew this as well. Whether he did or not, Richard didn't have time to ponder it. He climbed back out of the hole and up the rock face of the cliff. He noticed that the rock jutted out over the opening into the library. probably so that water wouldn't eat away at the plug over time or work its way inside. The sand had to be dry not only so that the books inside wouldn't be ruined, but so that it would pour out. Richard decided that for the time being the library was relatively safe from rain. At the top of the cliff, he stored the valuable blank book away in his pack. He saw that inside the stone rim, where there had been sand before, there was now a spiral stairway down into the darkness below. To make sure that no one discovered the library, he struggled mightily against the boulder until he managed to pivot it into place. Panting from the exertion, he swung his pack up onto his back. His mind was racing with 1,000 different thoughts. On the way back through the dark wood, Richard spoke little to the wisps, other than to thank them for their help. Once they had reached the meadow again, he gazed out over the sight of all the night wisps gliding through the grass and wildflowers, some spinning in an intricate dance as they moved together in pairs. He wondered how many more wisps there had been when Kaelin had been here. Richard missed Kaelin so much that it brought a lump to his throat. She was his world. The whole world in so many ways seemed to be slipping away. "I have to go," he told Tam and Jas. "I hope to use what I found here to help stop the suffering of the wisps and others."
"You will come back?" Jas asked.
Thinking briefly about the hidden library, Richard nodded. "Yes, and I hope to bring Kaelin with me, and that by then you will remember her. I know she will be overjoyed to see you all again."
"When we remember her," Jas said, "then we will be filled with joy, too."
Unwilling to test his voice again, Richard nodded and then started out. Tam escorted him through the ancient forest, helping him find the way. At the edge of the ancient trees, the wisp came to a halt.
"Arrakis was wise to choose you, Richard Cipher. I believe that you have it in you to succeed. I wish you well."
Richard smiled sadly. He wished he was as sure. He no longer had access to the gift within him, if it was still even there, and he had no idea how he would succeed. Maybe Zed could help. "Thank you, Tam. You and the wisps have been good protectors of those things Barakas left with you. I will do my best to protect you, and the other innocents who are in so much danger."
"If you fail, Richard Cipher, I know that it will not be from lack of effort on your part. If you ever need our help again, as Shar told you, say one of our names, and we will try to help you."
Richard nodded and started away, turning once to wave. The wisp spun a rose color for a moment, and then vanished back into the trees. He suddenly felt awfully forlorn by the light of the moon alone. The dead oaks seemed to go on forever. He plodded along in a numb daze. He needed to get some food and rest, but he wanted to get out of the strange wood and back down into the forest first. He saw bones among the roots of the oaks, as if the trees were trying to gather in the dead to hug them to their bosoms. Somewhere in the dead wood, after walking endlessly, absorbed in his troubled thoughts, Richard felt a sudden chill to the air that made him shudder and gasp the sharp cold into his lungs. It felt as if he had walked into the fangs of winter. When he looked up, he spotted what at first looked like an upright shadow among the skulls. When he saw at last what it really was, another shudder shivered up his spine. It was a tall woman with black, wiry hair. She wore inky black robes. Her skin was as pale as the moon, making her gaunt face seem to float in the darkness. Her desiccated flesh was stretched tight over her bony features, the way he imagined the dead would have looked for a time as they lay lifeless in this forsaken forest, waiting for the worms to do their work. A thin, menacing smile marked her unmistakably as the sort to leave the bones of used-up people to rot in just such a place, among the moldering dead. Richard felt so cold he couldn't move. He realized that he was shivering, but he couldn't seem to make himself stop. He couldn't feel his fingers or toes. He wanted to move, to run, but he couldn't force his legs to move. He had no gift to summon. He had no sword to draw. He felt helpless in the beguiling gaze of her blanched blue eyes. Richard wondered if his lifeless remains would end up discarded in this desolate place to rot, forgotten, along with all the other anonymous bones of those who had come with lofty dreams. The woman's arm swept up, like a raven lifting its wings, and the night swallowed him. Chapter 42. Kaelin ever so gradually became aware of the bewildering drone of voices, both near and far. She was so dazed, though, that she wasn't sure if it was real, or if she was only imagining it. She knew that some of the thoughts streaming endlessly through her mind had to be her imagination, despite how real they seemed. She knew that she wasn't one moment in a flowered field among the stars, the next moment in the middle of a pitched battle with desiccated corpses atop horseback, and the next instant flying through the clouds atop a red dragon's back. It all seemed real, but she knew that it couldn't be. After all, there weren't any such things as dragons. That was only myth. But if it really was voices that she was hearing, she couldn't understand the words. They came to her more as disembodied raw sounds, each tonal pulse resonating painfully with something deep inside her. What she was sure of was that her head throbbed in a slow rhythm, and each time the agonizing beat squeezed, it felt as if her skull would split open from the pressure. As each intermittent cycle subsided, nausea oozed up inside her, only to be forced back into relative insignificance once again by the next overwhelmingly torturous compression. Try as she might to open her eyes, Kaelin couldn't lift her heavy lids. It would have taken more strength than she could call forth right then. Besides, she feared that there might be light, and she was sure that light would hurt like long needles stabbing into her defenseless eyes. It felt as if some unknown, thick pressure were suspending her, keeping her immobile, while a hidden force tortured her under the throbbing pressure. Trying desperately to escape the grip of it, she attempted to bend her arms, but they were too stiff. She tried to move her legs or even to lift a knee, but her legs were tightly encased in the cocooning, dense darkness. A sound, possibly a harsh word, startled her, bringing her closer to the brink of wakening awareness, lifting her up through the numb confusion toward the world of life. This time she was sure that the sounds were voices. She began to be able to make out the occasional word. Like a lifeline, she mentally seized those words and used them to help pull herself up out of the dark dregs of unconsciousness. She breathed evenly, concentrating on the words, forcing the throbbing to the background as she listened carefully for each word, trying to string them together into meaningful concepts. She recognized women's voices, and a man's voice. A surly man. The pain of being awake, though, was even more debilitating than the dreamlike suffering she had felt while unconscious. Reality had a way of adding an agonizing dimension to the pain, an inescapable misery, a relentless torment throbbing through her body. In an effort to get her mind off the pain she was in, Kaelin opened her eyes just enough to peek out and take a careful look around. She was inside some kind of structure. It looked something like a tent made of a pale tan canvas. But if it really was a tent, it was much larger than any tent she remembered ever seeing before. Rich carpets hung to one side, looking to serve the purpose of double doors. She was lying on thick furs that were atop something slightly elevated, rather than being spread out on the floor. In the hot, muggy air, the furs were making her sweat. At least she wasn't covered with blankets. She thought that maybe she had been placed there to keep her out from underfoot, There was a chair with a carved back opposite where she lay, but no one sat in it. Several lamps sat around the room on chests, while others hung from chains. They did little to chase away the gloomy atmosphere inside the tent, but at least the smell of the burning oil helped cover the heavy stench of sweat, animals, and manure. Kaelin was relieved that the light didn't hurt her eyes as she'd feared it would. One of the sisters paced in the dim light, like a phantom who couldn't find her grave. Jumbled, muffled noises from outside drifted through the heavy canvas and carpeted walls of the tent. It sounded like a whole city surrounded the muted sanctuary. Kaelin could hear the murmured drone of men in the thousands, along with the clop of hooves, the rattle of wagons, the braying of mules, and the metallic jangle of weapons and armor. Men in the distance shouted orders, or laughed, or cursed, while those closer told stories she couldn't quite make out. Kaelin knew what this army was like. She had seen glimpses of it from afar, been through places where they had been, and had seen those that they'd tortured, raped, and murdered. She didn't want to ever have to go out there, among such savages as she knew these men were. When she noticed Jagang glance her way, she pretended to still be unconscious, breathing evenly, lying perfectly still, and keeping her eyes almost closed. Thinking she wasn't yet awake, his gaze drifted back to the pacing Sister Ulysia. "It can't be that simple," Sister Armina insisted from where she stood beside a table. She lifted her nose in a haughty manner. Kaelin could just make out the edge of a book on that table. Sister Armina's extended fingers rested on the book's leather cover.
"Armina," Jagang asked in a calm, almost pleasant voice, "can you even begin to imagine how entertaining it is for me to be in the mind of a troublesome sister that I send out to the tents to be passed around among my men?"
The woman paled as she backed up a step until her back met the tent wall. "No, Excellency."
"To be there, witnessing their dread? To be in their mind, seeing how completely helpless they are as powerful hands rip their clothes off and grope their bodies, as they are pushed to the bare ground, their legs forced open, and they are mounted by men who consider them of no value except as a bit of lustful entertainment. Men who have absolutely no sympathy for them at all, who don't care in the least what suffering they inflict in their heedless pursuit of what they want. Can you imagine how satisfying it is for me to be there, in the minds of such vexatious sisters, to be an eyewitness, so to speak, of their well-deserved punishment?"
Her eyes wide in panic, Sister Armina's voice was barely audible.
"No, Excellency."
"Then I suggest that you stop protesting, based not on what you think, but on what you think I want to hear. I'm not interested in your bootlicking. In my bed you may flatter me if you think it will gain you favor, which it won't. But in this I'm only interested in the truth. Your obsequious arguments will not make us successful. Only the truth will. If you have something worthwhile to say, then say it. But stop interrupting Ulysia to criticize her opinion with what you think I want to hear, or you will again be sent out to the tents sooner rather than later. Do you understand?"
Cowed, Sister Armina's gaze dropped away. "Yes, Excellency." Sister Ulysia took a settling breath as Jagang turned his attention on her. Her pacing came to a halt. She lifted an arm toward the book on the table. "The problem is, Excellency, there is no way for us to confirm if the copy inside is true or not. I know that's what you want us to do, and believe me, we've tried, but the truth is we can't find anything that could settle the matter."
"Why not?"
"Well, if it says, position the boxes facing north, how are we supposed to be able to detect if that is a true or false instruction just from reading it? For all we know, facing them north could be an accurate copy of the original manuscript, in which case not doing as it says would prove fatal. Or it could be a corruption of the true direction, and doing as it says would be fatal. How are we to know? You may wish us to be able to come to a conclusion as to the book's validity just from reading it, but we have no way of doing that.
I know you don't want me to lie to satisfy your request. I'm serving you best by being truthful. Jigang eyed her suspiciously. Be careful, Ulysia, not to cross the line into fawning. I'm not in the mood.
Sister Ulysia bowed her head. Of course, Excellency.
Jigang folded his husky arms across his massive chest and returned to the matter at hand. So you think that for this reason the ones who made the copies left us this other way to tell the false from true?
Yes, Excellency, Sister Ulysia said, despite looking anxious to be taking a stand that she knew would not please him.
Since the Emperor could read her thoughts, he would know the truth of what she honestly believed.
Kaelin imagined that Sister Ulysia reasoned that her best chance of not incurring his wrath was to be true to her belief.
Sister Ulysia was nothing if not smart. You believe that this is the real explanation, then? That it isn't a mistake, but that it was calculated and deliberate?
Yes, Excellency. There has to be some way to tell. Otherwise, the successful use of the book would only be the result of chance. The boxes of Warden were made as a counter. She paused as she glanced briefly Kaelin's way. Kaelin kept her eyes almost closed into the narrowest of slits, so that the woman wouldn't know she was awake. Sister Ulysia turned her attention back to Jigang. They would have reasoned that if it ever became necessary to use that counter, it could only be because the situation was desperate. So they would need very badly to know that the book was true, or else they risked losing everything they believed in. They would, after all, be using the book to save everything they believed in. If the ones using the counter of the boxes were wrong about the copy they were referring to, then they stood to lose more than just their lives. They risked losing the world of life itself.
Unless those who made the copies wanted the false copies to foil a greedy thief, Jigang said.
But, Excellency, Sister Ulysia said, to stop any treacherous plans, those in charge of the boxes would need to have a way to know the true copies from the false. If they didn't leave such a method to those who would come after them, then they would have abandoned their descendants to survival by chance. Their whole reason for making the copies in the first place was because they were worried about the risks that might develop in the future with having only the original text. After all, the only book in existence would be subject to any number of threats, from fire to water to worms, and that isn't even including the array of deliberate threats. They were trying to make sure that there would be an accurate copy if it ever came to be necessary to use the boxes, and the original book was unavailable for reasons they might not even be able to imagine. Risking that future on chance would be counter to their purpose for making the copies in the first place. Do you see what I mean? Since they made only one true copy, and the rest false, they were attempting to discourage the wrongful use of the boxes, putting another obstacle in the path of them being used. But at the same time, if the boxes were ever truly needed, they most certainly would not have wanted that call to have been answered by chance. They would have left those coming after them a way to confirm the truth. Since the text inside the book is not contradictory in and of itself, it seems to me that those who made the copies would unquestionably have devised another means to determine the true from false.
Jigang turned to the other sister. Ah, Amina has had a thought. Do speak up, darling.
Sister Amina cleared her throat. We are being asked to believe that a singular rather than a plural word served as their only indication of validity. Sister Amina shook her head. While I grant the general point, I believe that this is just too simple an answer, if not far too opaque a message. This means of telling true from false in and of itself becomes chance, too.
Unless they gave us a way to confirm it. And they have, now haven't they?
Sister Ulysia arched an eyebrow as she leaned a little toward the woman. It's right there, right in the beginning, where it tells us precisely how to detect if the book is true or not. It says that she must verify it.
She has.
Armina folded her arms. Like I said, I think that's just too simple to be the answer.
If it's so simple, Armina, then why didn't you see it? Sister Ulysia asked.
Kaelin closed her eyes a little more when Sister Ulysia pointed at her. She found the flaw. Why did none of us see it? Only she saw it.
Without her, we probably would not have noticed it, or, if we had, we probably would have thought that it couldn't be important and we would have ignored it.
She has done what the book said she must. She found it. She said that it means the copy is a false copy. That is precisely the purpose for which the book itself said she must be used. Some of us may not consider that flaw complex enough to be the determining element, but that's irrelevant. The fact remains that she must verify the veracity of this book, and because of a flaw that only she noticed, she claims it is a false copy. That's what matters. We have to take that pronouncement as valid. Considering the words of each woman, Jigang rubbed a meaty hand back over his bull neck as he paced before the table. He stared down at the book for a time, then spoke. "There is one way to be sure." He glared at each sister in turn. "We find the other copies and compare them. If they all, or only a few, have this exact same flaw in the title, then it would point to it being meaningless. On the other hand, if all but one has this same flaw, then the one that doesn't would likely be the true copy. We can then compare all the versions of the text, and if the one without the flawed title is different from all the others, we will have confirmed that it's the one true copy."
"Excellency," Sister Armina said with a deferential bow of her head, "that is an excellent idea. If we can locate the others, and this is the only one with this flaw, then it would prove my point that it is nothing but a simple, isolated mistake by an ignorant bookbinder."
Jigang stared at her for a moment before finally breaking eye contact and going to a chest to the side. He opened the top and pulled out a book. He tossed it on the table so that it slid across the top toward the two sisters. Sister Armina picked it up and read the cover. Even in the dim light of the oil lamps, Kaelin could see the woman's face going a deep shade of red.
"The Book of Counted Shadow," she said in an incredulous whisper.
"Shadow?" Sister Elisa asked, peering down over Sister Armina's shoulder. "Not shadows?"
"No," Jigang said. "It is the Book of Counted Shadow, the same as the one from Casca."
But, Sister Armina stammered, "I don't understand. Where is this copy from?"
A condescending smile joined his glare.
"The Palace of the Prophets."
Sister Armina's jaw dropped in speechless shock. Sister Elysia frowned.
"What? That can't be. Are you sure?" "Am I sure?" he grunted in derision. "Oh, yes, I'm sure. You see, I've had this book for quite some time. That is part of the reason why I allowed you fools to continue in your quest. I needed the same woman you were after in order to find out if this is a true copy or not. All the time I had this book, I never noticed the word shadow in the title as being anything other than what it should be. I just assumed it said what it was supposed to say. But our unconscious friend over there noticed it immediately."
"But how could you have gotten this from the Palace of the Prophets?" Sister Elysia asked. "From what we've learned, these copies were buried with bones, as in Casca, in hidden catacombs. No catacombs were ever discovered at the palace before it was destroyed."
Jigang smiled to himself, as if he were explaining things to children. "You think you are so clever, Elysia, finding out about the boxes, about the book needed to open them, about the catacombs, and about the one person needed to verify the text of the book. But I have known for decades what you have only recently discovered. I have been visiting mines for a very, very long time to aid our cause. You would be surprised at all the things I learned long ago. While you sisters were engaged in palace politics, in battles for power on your own little island, in courting either the creator or the keeper, seeking favors in return for loyalty to one or the other, I have been working to unite the old world in the cause of the Fellowship of Order, which is the true cause of the creator and therefore the only righteous cause of mankind. While you were teaching young men to be wizards, I was showing those same young men the true light. Without the sisters even being aware of it, many of those young wizards had already devoted themselves to the future salvation of mankind by becoming disciples of the Order. They spent decades walking the halls of the Palace of the Prophets, right under the noses of the sisters, while working as brothers of the Fellowship of Order.
and I was there in their minds as they read all those restricted books down in the vaults of the palace. As a dreamwalker, I gave them direction and purpose in their studies. I knew what was needed. I had them search for me. As brothers of the Order, they long ago found the secret entrance down into the catacombs. It was hidden under an unused and long-forgotten storage area in the older section of the stables. They spirited this book, as well as other valuable volumes, out of the catacombs, and then when I finally arrived at the palace after triumphantly unifying the old world, they delivered them to me. I have had this particular copy for decades. The only thing I didn't have was a way through the Great Barrier, so that I could get at both the boxes and the means of verification. But then, through their meddling, the sisters obliged me by doing things that resulted in the destruction of that barrier. Now that the Palace of the Prophets has been destroyed, I am afraid that the catacombs and the books they held have been lost for all time. But those young men searched through most of those hidden volumes, and through their eyes I read most of them. The palace and the catacombs are now gone. But not all the knowledge contained there has been lost. Those young men grew up to become brothers, many still alive and serving in our struggle. When I witnessed you hatch your plan to capture the Mother Confessor, I realized I could use that plan to finally get my hands on her, and use her for my purposes. So I allowed you to think you were accomplishing exactly what you wanted, while you were, in fact, accomplishing what I wanted. I now have the book, and the Mother Confessor that the book says must be used to confirm its validity.
Both sisters could only stare. Kaelin's mind spun in confusion. Mother Confessor. She was the Mother Confessor. What in the world was a Mother Confessor? Jigang flashed the sisters a cunning smile.
You have been the perfect fools, don't you think?
Yes, Excellency. They both conceded as one in small voices.
So you see, he went on, we now have two copies of the Book of Counted Shadows, and both have the same mistake, the word shadow instead of shadows on the cover.
But this is still only two, Sister Armina said. What if all the other copies have the same flaw?
I don't think that's going to happen, Sister Alicia said.
Well, if they did, it would certainly prove something, now wouldn't it?
Jigang arched a questioning eyebrow over one dark eye.
I now have two, and they have the exact same error. We will need to have the rest to confirm the theory that one will have the title written correctly as Shadows. So, as it turns out, we will need to keep the Mother Confessor alive until we can see if she has really found the flaw that will verify the true copy.
And if all the copies have the same flaw, Excellency? Sister Armina asked.
Then we will have learned that the error in the title isn't the method for verifying the Book of Counted Shadows. It may turn out that we need to give her access to the copy itself so that she can have a broader basis for making the verification, for making it on things that for now she isn't able to see.
Sister Armina lifted a hand. But, Excellency, I don't know that such a thing is even possible.
Jigang didn't answer Armina's concern, but instead took the book from her and set it beside the one on the table. The Mother Confessor is still vital to us. She is the only way to verify the one true copy. We can't yet be certain that she has done that. So far, she made a judgment on the only information available to her. For now, we need her alive.
Yes, Excellency, Sister Armina said. I think she might be waking, Sister Alicia said. Kaelin realized that she had been listening so intently that she had failed to completely close her eyes when Sister Alicia looked her way. The sister came closer, peering down at her. Kaelin didn't want them to know she had heard them call her by the title Mother Confessor. She stretched a little, as if trying to escape the bounds of unconsciousness while she tried to imagine what such a title could possibly mean. "Where are we?" she mumbled, feigning a groggy voice.
I am confident that it will soon enough become all too clear to you. Sister Alicia forcefully jabbed Kaelin's shoulder. Now wake up.
What is it?
Do you wish something, sister? Kaelin rubbed her eyes with the backs of her knuckles, trying to look uncoordinated and dazed. Where are we? Sister Alicia hooked a finger through the collar around Kaelin's neck and jerked her upright. Before Sister Alicia could say anything more, Jagang's meaty hand grabbed her arm and drew her back out of his way. He was intent on Kaelin. His fist seized her shirt at her throat. He lifted her clear of the ground.
You killed two trusted guards, he said through gritted teeth. You killed Sister Cecilia.
His face was going red with rapidly building rage. His brow drew down over his dark eyes. It seemed that lightning might flicker in the cloudy shapes drifting through those black eyes.
What made you think that you could get away with killing them?
I didn't think I could get away with it, Kaelin said as calmly as she could manage. As she had suspected, her calm only served to provoke his fury.
He roared in unleashed anger, and shook her so violently that it felt like it might have torn muscles in her neck.
It was obvious that he was a man who, at the slightest provocation, flew into fits of uncontrollable rage. He was on the brink of murder. Kaelin didn't want to die, but she knew that a swift death might be preferable to what he had promised her for later. She couldn't really do anything to stop it anyway.
If you didn't think you could get away with it, then why would you dare to do such a thing?
What difference does it make? Kaelin asked with calm indifference, as his fists on her shirt held her up so that her boots were clear of the ground.
What are you talking about?
Well, you've already told me that your treatment of me will be terrible beyond anything I have ever experienced. I believe you. That's the only way people like you can ever win, by threats and brutality. Because you are such a pompous fool, you made the mistake of telling me that I could not begin to imagine all the terrible things you intend to do to me. That was your big mistake.
Mistake? What are you talking about?
He drew her up against his muscled body.
What mistake?
You've made a tactical error, Emperor, Kaelin said, managing to stress his title in a way that made it sound like a mocking insult. She wanted him angry, and she could see that it was working. Despite hanging from his white-knuckled fists, Kaelin tried to sound composed, even aloof. You see, you have made it clear to me that no matter what I do, I have nothing to lose. You've made it clear that you can't be reasoned with. You said that you are going to do your worst to me. That empowers me because I am no longer bound by any hope for mercy from you. In revealing that I have no hope whatsoever for any mercy, you have given me an advantage I didn't previously have. You see, by making that mistake, you showed me that I had nothing to lose by killing your guards, and since I'm to be subjected to your worst anyway, I might as well have my revenge on Sister Cecilia. By making such a tactical mistake, you have shown me that you are not so smart after all, that you are just a brute and can be bested. He relaxed his grip just enough for Kaelin to touch the toes of her boots to the ground, so that she could gain some leverage.
You really are something, he said as a slow, cunning smile overcame his rage. I'm going to enjoy what I have planned for you.
I've already told you your mistake, and you repeat it. Apparently you don't learn very well either, do you? Before, when he'd pulled her up against him in a rage and had brought her face close to his, when his hands had been firmly occupied holding her in a threatening manner, Kaelin had used the distraction to gingerly slip his knife from the sheath on his belt. With two fingers, she'd worked it up into her hand. He had been so angry he hadn't noticed. Rather than get worked up into another fit of rage at her latest insult, he began to laugh. Kaelin already had his knife gripped tightly in her fist. Without ceremony or warning, she thrust it at him as hard as she could. Her intention had been to drive the blade up under his ribs, to cut open vital organs, maybe even his heart, if she could get it in that far. The way he was holding her, though, hampered her movement just enough so that she missed her mark by a fraction of an inch, and instead struck his lowest rib. The point stuck in bone. Before she had time to yank it back and stab him again, he seized her wrist and wrenched her arm over, spinning her around. Her back slammed against his chest. He had the knife out of her grip before she had a chance to do anything about it. his arm across her throat cut off her air as he held her against his massive muscles. His chest heaved in anger against her back. Rather than admitting defeat, and before she blacked out from lack of air, she used all her muscle to drive the heel of her boot into his shin. By his cry, she knew it hurt. She struck sharply with her elbow directly into the fresh wound. He flinched. As her elbow rebounded from the blow, she cocked it forward to gain momentum and then smashed back into his jaw. He was so big, though, so strong, that it didn't have a disabling effect. It had been rather like punching a bull, and like a bull, it only enraged him further. Looking no worse for her attack, Jigang seized a fistful of her shirt before she could slip out of his reach. He punched her in the middle hard enough to double her over and drive her breath from her lungs. She gasped, trying to draw a breath against the stunning pain. Kaelin realized that she was on her knees only when he lifted her by her hair and placed her back on her feet. Her knees wobbled unsteadily. Jigang was grinning. His flash of anger had been washed away by an unexpected, dangerous, but one-sided brawl and an opportunity to inflict pain. He was beginning to enjoy the game.
This is the end of disc number 15. Please continue listening on disc number 16.